are listening to Teacher Talk It, supporting teachers, parents and students worldwide. teachertalkit.co.uk. Like, subscribe and follow to stay in the know.
Where we are now, if you're at GCSE, I, as a teacher of, let's say, history, have to decide whether you're a foundation student or a higher tier student, same in maths. Essentially, I'm predetermining your future about what grade you can get.
We help teachers thrive and survive with classroom ideas, cutting-edge school resources, and research-informed teacher training materials. You will also hear discussions on the policy, guidance, and research-based publications.
Hi, and welcome to this episode of the Teacher Toolkit podcast. I am your host, Libby Isaac, and I am absolutely privileged in this episode to get to talk to the one and only Jeff Barton. Now, I'm sure you all know who Jeff Barton is, so without further ado, I'm going to bring him into the conversation and we're going to have a fantastic chat. So thank you so much, Jeff, for coming on the podcast.
No, delighted to, Libby. Thank you very much for asking me to do so.
Well, it's giving up your time, and I know how incredibly busy you are, but you're very well known for giving up your time for the teachers out there. So thank you again.
Yeah, well, I mean, teaching is in my bloodstream.
I know
the whole business of being an English teacher. It's funny. There's not an hour that goes by when I don't use some of the skills, either in what I'm saying, what I'm writing, what I'm thinking. I've just read a book about being an English teacher. I just, you know, you can take English teacher out of us, but you can't take us out of being an English teacher. It is absolutely central to what we do. And that's the same for all subjects, I think, probably.
Well, I'm a historian at heart, so it's the same for that. So just to introduce yourself just a little bit, can you just tell the people that are listening a bit about where you started and where you came from? Because obviously you trained to be an English teacher, and then what it is you're doing now, that'd be great.
Yes, I will do. And I'll use a sentence, Libby, that probably people haven't heard before, that when I was young, I wanted to be, wait for it, Noel Edmonds. Okay, there we are. That always gets a bit of a laugh, actually, that comment. And those people who've heard me say that before will know that basically when I was a kid, I wanted to be Radio 1's breakfast DJ. And Noel Edmonds, when I was growing up, was Radio 1's breakfast DJ. He was an extraordinary, creative, funny DJ. I wanted to do that. And didn't, but I went into the sixth form with some very bad O-level results, and just suddenly my eyes were opened up to the subject of English in a way that was just extraordinary for me. I'd read a little bit in the past, but I hadn't been a big reader. I'd never read Shakespeare. I had a great teacher called Roy Sampson, and I just wanted to be Roy Sampson, and as a result, I went and did an English degree. I went then and trained to become an English teacher. I did 32 years, I think, as an English teacher. But within that, I did 15 years also of being a head teacher when I taught throughout that time. And it was just a fantastic thing to do. Many of those skills, as we've said, I have continued to use in this job, which is General Secretary of the Association of School and College Leaders. I represent 22,000 school and college leaders. But at the heart of what we do, we are the guardians of the nation's young people, and the teachers and other staff, teaching assistants and other staff who look after them. So that's been the trajectory, I suppose.
Brilliant. And it's not quite the same, but I absolutely want to be a radio presenter as well. And I said to my parents,
well, you've made it.
That was my dream. It was going to be a professional snowboarder. So definitely didn't do those ones either, but there must be something in it. Can I just ask, if you were to give yourself some advice when you were 16 years old, what would it be? What would you say to yourself now?
Oh, I'd probably say then worry less about stuff. Mm-hmm. To be honest, on a day when I've had a fairly day today for various reasons, I would probably be saying to myself, now worry less, because the things that you are worrying about probably aren't going to happen. But it's easier said than done, all of that. And I think one of the signs of people who aspire to be really good at what they do, whether it's in teaching, whether it's in other professions. We probably set a high bar for ourselves and we probably beat ourselves up because we haven't quite got there. And I think we all think, why don't you just worry less about it? You know, a former student of mine, Oliver Burtman, has written this brilliant book called 4,000 Weeks. And it's essentially, if you live to the average age of 80, how many weeks on the planet will you spend? And the answer is 4,000 weeks. And he says, if you've got 4,000 weeks, spend some time thinking, what do you want to do? What do you not want to do? What should you worry about? What should you not worry about? I'd like to say to my 16-year-old self, it's probably stuff you were worrying about then you don't need to worry about. And I'd probably say to my 59-year-old self, it's probably stuff you're still worrying about you don't need to, because actually a lot of that stuff that worries you isn't going to happen anyway. And Oliver Burtman, my former student, I pay tribute to you for teaching me that, even if I don't always put it into practice.
That's absolutely brilliant advice. And I think in particular for teachers at the moment, because we are worrying a lot. And I think if we move in to talk a little bit about that. So obviously at the moment, we're just about to start the GCSEs. And I know that in primary schools, they are starting their 2 weeks of SATs as well. So there is so much worry and anxiety out there for students from teachers, because students are, they're not prepared mentally, they're not prepared academically. Obviously, they're having to push on with curriculum and GCSEs, which is really tough considering the amount of missed learning. So I suppose sort of my question to you is, what advice could you offer perhaps a teacher just about to, you know, go on that journey with their year 11s or their year 6 students? So what kinds of things could you say to them to make them worry less, I suppose?
Well, I think there's probably two things around that, Libby. I think there's the immediate and there's the longer term stuff. So the immediate is, I think the teaching profession, teachers, teaching assistants, leaders have done extraordinary things against a very, very challenging backdrop, often with lots of kind of snarky, mischievous, nasty criticism from the sidelines. I think what they've done is to do their very best to get those young people ready for the Key Stage 2 tests, even if they don't believe in those tests. And I've got very mixed feeling about those tests, and similarly around GCSE and A-level. And what we're seeing from a survey that we've done with our leaders is levels of anxiety from young people are worse than they have been for years. So there's very significant amounts of anxiety, understandably, because those kids haven't done exams before. They've been told that exams are the be-all and end-all, you know, blah, 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 and therefore that it's very high stakes. So my first point would just be to say, well done on what you have done, but let's keep those things in perspective. My second point would be to people who are leading our schools and colleges. I think there comes a point, and you and I are speaking on the day when we've got a Queen's speech in Parliament, mm-hmm. which is pretty woeful, pretty uninspiring, pretty low key. There comes a point when I think those of us who are leaders in schools are going to say, enough is enough. We cannot continue to allow young people to be defined by the grades they get, whether it's at Key Stage 2, whether it's their numeracy and literacy, and a government saying it's going to be 95% of kids are going to get national standards, whether it's going to be how many kids are going to get grade 4 and above. That is a terrible indictment of our system, that we define things so narrowly around that. And it feels to me as if there is a momentum building of saying, we're not going to carry on doing this. And if the government isn't going to show vision around all of this, then actually if enough multi-academy trusts, if enough independent schools and other types of schools say, we will do what we think is right for our young people and not obsess around grades and everything that follows from that, the Ofsted ratings, the performance tables, and all of that stuff, we're going to be defiant against that. I think that would be an extraordinary watermark in our system. And I just sense that there are enough people who are now saying, we cannot continue with this very reductive education system that in England in particular, more than Wales, more than Scotland, more than Northern Ireland, we have allowed to be created.
Absolutely. I suppose after the First World War, I'm a historian, First World War, the Second World War, education was turned upside down, wasn't it? That there was a new system put in place by the government. So there was a part of, I think, a lot of us that thought, you know, coming through a pandemic, perhaps this is a really good time to rethink the GCSE system, rethink the curriculum system. But it doesn't seem to have happened, which is really frustrating.
No, I think it is. But one of the things about the job I've got now is I'm kind of steeped in the political realities. And what you see of politicians is they're good people. You know, they went into politics to do good public service, but they are locked into short-termism. So what they're basically doing is looking, in the case of the current government, at what can we achieve in the next two years. Well, what they won't be able to achieve is a complete reform of GCSE, A-level, Key Stage 2 tests. There's no time for it. So they immediately take that off the agenda. And what we really need, I think, is to lift a bit of a sense of education policy out of that short-termism, get a coalition of people saying, if we're genuinely doing stuff on behalf of children and young people, what do we need to do over the next 10, 15, 20 years? In China, they talk about 30-year plans. What does education look like in the longer term? And I know some people will listen to this and think this is, you know, kind of utopian, hyperbolic nonsense. But at some point, we do need to inject a sense of vision into our education, because education ought to be the most optimistic part of our society. And at the moment, I think for many kids, particularly those Key Stage 2 kids who are doing their tests this week and next week, some of those won't have done any PE in sport, for example, for the past 2 years, because all they're doing is being drilled on spelling. How can we possibly look ourselves in the eye and think that that is a good primary education? We have to. If the government is going to do it, we have to do it on behalf of children and young people. And just maybe what COVID has done for us is to allow us to talk to parents in a way that we hadn't done previously, because parents have seen what teachers have achieved.
Absolutely. So if you could reform the GCSEs realistically, what things would you focus on? I know you recently you published an article and you spoke about IT and you spoke about sort of the mental health and well-being of pupils. Can you just talk to us a bit about that, please?
Yeah, so we've done a survey of members, and it shows us that the biggest issue around GCSE and A level at the moment is not can we recruit invigilators? It is actually, we are concerned about the mental health of our young people. Mm-hmm. Now, part of that is driven by anxiety. We're all anxious about everything all the time. That's the new normal. But secondly, if you're a student at GCSE who's going to sit 27, 30, 35 possibly papers, that does seem madness for a qualification designed in a completely different era when you would be leaving school. But now you're not going to leave school. You will move on to a sixth form. You'll go into apprenticeships. You'll go and do T levels, whatever it might be. Surely we need to do something around that. And I think I'm not quite in the camp of people who say, so let's abolish GCSEs. I'm in the camp of people who say, let's replace it with something that shows maybe at the age of 14, 15, maybe 16, here's what I can do in the basics of English and maths. We would call it an English or maths passport. So it's built on the idea of demonstrating what you can do rather than denigrating you for what you can't do if you're a grade 3, grade 2, grade 1. But if you were to do that, that would then clear the way between 14 and 18 for you to then be able to focus those young people on what are the skills, what is the knowledge they need in the next phase of their learning. So we're kind of exploring what does that look like. And we've got exam boards who are genuinely interested, I think, in saying, is there some kind of particularly digital, possibly online qualification that allows young people to say, here's what I can do. And they've got the independent sense of not just their teachers, but someone who's examining them saying, here's what I can do, but actually not this obsession with so many exams that we've got at the moment. So early stages, but I think there is genuine interest in doing something different around that.
Well, it sounds so exciting and completely what I see in and out of the corridors and in the classroom as well. Like, it completely reflects what's happening, and why wouldn't you do something that the students will be doing something in the future with, in particular to do with IT, because they're far, far above and beyond anything that I'm at with that.
I think so. And also, you know, one of the things I'm on the Times Education Commission, and the Times would rather boldly say this is the biggest education commission that has looked at education in the past 100 years. So that's the kind of hubris of it, the rhetoric of it. But actually, taking your point, Libby, they're looking back to the Second World War when you had Rab Butler and others mm-hmm. who were saying, OK, we're coming out of a national crisis. What does our education system now need to look at, and how do we define that? And they didn't have any money. They weren't particularly kind of charismatic politicians, but they started to think what education looks like. And what the Times Commission is saying is the same thing. And one of the points I made at a meeting of commissioners today was, if you look back at the GCSE, it was the most democratic decision about a qualification, whereby you didn't have to decide whether you, Libby, were a CSE student or a GCSE or O-level student. I was not predetermining what grade you could get. Instead, GCSE allowed you to have the same system of being judged, whether you're from a poor background or a rich mm-hmm. background. It was a really good democratic moment. But it seems to me that where we are now, if you're at GCSE, I, as a teacher of, let's say, history, have to decide whether you're a foundation student or a higher tier student, same in maths. Essentially, I'm predetermining your future about what grade you can get. Now, IT can do something different from that. IT will ask you, as a history student, some questions. And based on your answers, it will ask you harder questions or easier questions. And it will get to a point when it asks you questions and determines, here's the grade you have got. So everybody starts from the same starting point, and the technology does the heavy lifting, just like it does with our theory test in the driving license, for example, when people are going doing their driving test. And just as technology has transformed the way we do healthcare, the way we shop online, etc., why don't we use that for assessment purposes and really move to the next stage of a really democratic system of judging what level kids are at? And if what that means is that technology does the heavy lifting, what that then does is to clear the way for teachers, human beings, to do the stuff that the robots can't do, which is basically teaching you stuff, using empathy, using creativity, using humour. I think that's an extraordinary moment for us if we seize it. The government won't seize it because they're myopic, inward-looking. But I think we are going to see exam boards, Ofqual, and schools and trusts and independent schools starting to say, enough is enough.
Absolutely. And I suppose my next question, thinking about Key Stage 3. So what do you think about sort of assessment and curriculum wise for Key Stage 3? Where do you see that going or could go in the future?
Well, I think if you look back probably, 6 or 7 years, Michael Wilshaw was the head of Ofsted, controversial head of Ofsted, and he came out with a report called Key Stage 3, The Wasted Years. I always thought that was a terrible title.
It's almost flipped it now, isn't it?
But the notion of it actually was quite a good one, and you hear it from Amanda Spielman, current head of Ofsted, when she says that there have been occasions when she's been into a Year 7, for example, history lesson, where what the teacher's been saying is, if you do GCSE history, you are going to get questions like this, and therefore here in Year 7, we're going to give you some practice questions on that. So in other words, suddenly we get this Year 7 kid on a long and tedious trajectory for 5 years just doing exam preparation. And I think that kind of implies that we've lost the sense of what Key Stage 3 is for. Key Stage 3 ought to be about breadth. It ought to be about exploring the curriculum. It ought to be about having fun around stuff. In English, which is my subject, let's do less analysis and more wide reading. Let's get kids reading as much as possible so that you whet their appetite, so that when you then get to Key Stage 4 and preparation for exams, you're starting to take that breadth and you're starting to apply it. I think we have lost a bit of a sense of that. Now, the government would say maybe one answer to that is that you introduce a Key Stage 3 test of literacy and numeracy in order that you show key stage three is different from key stage four. I worry about that because I think what that does is just to make key stage three a trajectory to a different kind of test. You know,
I agree,
and ultimately, I think that this is about the profession saying we understand that key stage three is something different from key stage four. We're going to do the different stuff. It's going to be about breadth and knowledge. We're not going to reference exams until we get to year 10. Let's have the confidence to do all of that kind of thing. But of course, it's easy to say that if you haven't got the ghost of Ofsted hanging over you with all the consequences that we know that brings to you.
Absolutely. And it would be nice at key stage three if staff were held accountable for the gaps in the curriculum, the gaps in the knowledge, so that they're looking at the knowledge and the curriculum and that's been brought alive rather than panicking because they're not meeting FFT targets that come from SATs, for example, that don't equate to different subjects.
Exactly. Yeah. Totally.
So I've got to ask the question. What would you have as an alternate for Ofsted, if any?
Well, I think probably I differ from other people in thinking that we do need to have some kind of external inspectorate. So I would agree with the idea that there should be inspection. I think the problem with the inspection system that we've got at the moment is, A, the consequences are so high. So I know from my first year in this job at Askell that in the east of England, there were 3 head teachers who lost their jobs because of bad inspection reports, even though they had only been in the job for 1 year. That has to be a bad thing because learning, as we know, takes time. Improving a school takes time. So I think something which has got an inspectorate, which is basically saying, here's what we're noticing, here's what the mirror we're holding up to you is telling us, here's the things we're suggesting to you you need to do differently, and let's us come back over the next 6 months, 2 years, 3 years, and help you to improve that school, would, I think, change the inspectorate, the inspection system from being something which is done to people, from actually done with people, and giving a sense of support around that. Now, what that looks like in practice is hard to say. I do think that the grading system is very problematic. I think the idea that you can define a school as being outstanding or good or requires improvement is incredibly reductive, because what we all know is that some days I will teach a lesson and it will be fantastic. Some days I will teach the same lesson to a different group. It'll be pretty terrible. That's the way learning works. So I think something which moves us into a narrative rather than into a sense of using numbers to judge things would be better. Some people would listen to that and say, well, why don't we have a system that just says either a school is good enough or not good enough? So you create a kind of completely binary system. The trouble with doing that is you make the stakes even higher, because if you are a not good enough school, there's no room for manoeuvre. You are being deemed as a failing school, essentially. So I think probably what we would say is, could we move to a system which basically gives parents a set of bullet points on a page of A4? Here's what this school at this moment in time appears to be doing well. Here's what the school could be working on. We will support them over the next couple of years, help them to do the things they're going to be working on. I think that would just take some of the pressure out of the system, and it would encourage people who, frankly, are the kind of people we need to go and work in the places that most need great teachers, great leaders, to go and actually stay in those areas rather than feeling that they're going to be criticised at the end of the first 9 months, potentially to the point where they have to leave the school. So it would be a system which I think would have enough rigour for parents. They knew they were getting something helpful, like TripAdvisor gives you something helpful, but without it having the high stakes that we've got at the moment. So something around that. And I think what we hear from the Labour Party at the moment, who I think are on manoeuvres with all of this, is they don't want to scrap Ofsted, but they do want to reform Ofsted. And I think the direction of travel for me would be, let's make Ofsted part of the school improvement process rather than the kind of finger-wagging mentality that we've got too much of at the moment.
And I'm sure they won't mind, but I did a podcast last month with two former HMI inspectors, and they both said the same thing, that it's very difficult to make judgment over 2 days that holds so much around it, like you said, about, you know, head teachers having to leave jobs and things. And also there's a moral purpose within the systems. To scrap a quality assurance system is really difficult, because what if the schools are failing? That's the duty to the students to make sure that it's helped to be improved. And one of them said that it would be really great to, you know, get back the points where the school's quality assurance system is more emphasis around, you know, the self-evaluation of the school from the head teacher, because the current framework has moved away from that self-evaluation, and then spending time, you know, talking to the head teacher about the school, about, you know, where they think the school is at and what needs to change and things.
Yes, I think that feels right to me. And of course, you've always got kind of political red meat going on with all of this, because what you will find from politicians is they want, quite rightly, to be able to say to parents and taxpayers, we are spending your money, here's what the quality of education is like, the independent inspector is therefore important. So you don't want to dilute that too much. But nevertheless, I mean, the last inspection I had, I said to the inspector at the end of 2 days, you know, frankly, John, he was the inspector, you might as well have stayed at home and just phoned this in, because all you've done is to look at our data and to make an assumption that because our results are like this, therefore the school is like this. Now, I think we've moved on in some ways from that, but there are still all kinds of questions around that. You know, I'm someone who's got a grade C in chemistry, right, from O-level days, 1980, I don't know, when did I do them? 1979, okay. If I was an inspector and we were doing a deep dive into science, so presumably I'm then going to have a discussion about the curriculum with the head of science or the head of chemistry using my 40-year-old knowledge about chemistry, is that really sensible, or does that basically give a sense that you as the head of chemistry are being judged on your ability to explain stuff? It's not actually about the subject, it's not about the curriculum, it's about your ability to explain to me what it is you're doing. I think we could be more nuanced and more grown up about all of that, and basically to say, what are the things that matter to parents? And I think probably the things that matter to parents are broader than this. Of course, they want to know about exam standards, but they want to know, what's the quality of extracurricular activity? What are the opportunities given to young people? What's the turnover of staff like? Do we keep staff in this school, and how do we develop and train them? What's the safeguarding and training stuff like? I think there's various things where you could actually just provide some quite useful information, but without grading it, unless there's a disaster there, which would be reassuring and helpful for parents, helpful and reassuring for leaders, not sending them off thinking, I need to move somewhere else because this place is too difficult to be able to get a decent judgment. And that would seem to me like the next incarnation of a inspection framework, which is genuinely, as Ofsted said it is, working for the greater good of young people. So that for us, given that we've got a chief inspector who will be finishing at the end of next year, there will need to be a new framework at some point. Yeah. Let's start to be a little bit more grown up about what that looks like, I think.
But could you be the next chief inspector, Jeff?
No, I think I definitely couldn't. No.
Okay, so what I'm going to do now, because I'm very aware of the time and it's been fantastic, is I'm going to do a bit of a quiz just so that we can get to know you. And obviously this is for teachers. So try and say your answers as quickly as possible. And see how you get on. So off the top of your head, what piece of educational research do you really think stands the test of time? What's your favourite piece?
Oh dear, educational research. Well, the person I go to the most is Deborah Myhill. Mm-hmm. She's Professor of Education, University of Exeter. She writes about literacy. She makes the point that your ability to read is based on your ability to listen. Your ability to write is based on your ability to speak. there's something very powerful about that, which brings oracy back to the heart of education. Deborah Myhill, she's great on grammar, great on oracy.
Okay, so I suppose my next question following on to that is, who do you think I should interview and hear next and why?
I think there are some veterans of education who've seen lots of stuff going on, who are sometimes denigrated, I noticed by the Twitterati. Someone like Tim Brighouse, I think, who was in charge of education in Birmingham, in Oxfordshire. He was behind the National Challenge in London. I think he is deeply wise. And one of the reasons I think he's deeply wise is he said, when he was in Oxfordshire in Birmingham, there should be 10 things that every child should experience as part of their education. Going on a residential, for example, going to the theatre, and other stuff. And it wasn't all kind of soft stuff. Some real rigour, which led to London becoming so outstanding. I think Tim Brighouse and Mick Waters, who works with him, they should not be sidelined. I think we can learn a lot from those people.
I will see if you can connect us after the recording.
I will do that. I will definitely do that. You would. I think you would be inspired by them.
Oh, that sounds amazing. So what would your dream job be if you weren't a teacher or a radio presenter?
If I wasn't either of those, I would probably like to be a food photographer. Because my hobby is cooking. I love food. When I finish this job in the next few years, I'm going to step out of education, I think, probably altogether. I'd like to do something with food. And taking pictures of beautiful food, wow, I'd love to do that.
Well, you could just do that on Instagram. Lots of people like to do that on Instagram.
I could, yeah.
No, that sounds brilliant. So my next question is, what piece of advice would you give to an ECT today?
Oh, I think I would just say you're in the most privileged of roles, but it's a difficult role. And anyone who makes you think that you can get it right at first go is completely wrong. I mean, there's a great book called, I've got it here somewhere, Graham Nuttall, The Hidden Lives of Learners. Okay, Graham Nuttall was a researcher, and what he pointed out is you can watch the same teacher teaching the same lesson to different kids, and sometimes it's genius and sometimes it just doesn't work. That's the reality, and that's also the joy of being a teacher. So don't beat yourself up about this stuff. Just see it as part of how you develop your learning about it all the time. One of the great things for me was right to my last day as a teacher, having started off many years before that, was how you constantly adapt your practice according to the group who are there in front of you, and you keep learning about how you can do it better and better.
Exactly. And I've actually just started at a new school, and it's hard work.
Some classes
you're winning and some you're really not.
I know. Well, I think there's a very important point there, because when you move to a new school, like I did as deputy head and then as head teacher, you kind of assume that because I'm coming in here and I'm now deputy or head, somehow the kids will all be in awe of me and it'll all be straightforward. Quite the opposite.
Yeah.
It's quite the opposite. And you really have to work at that. And that can undermine your self-belief, because the credibility, the confidence you had in your previous role just disappears. You need to rework at that. And I think even just as legitimizing that by talking about it, actually is probably helpful for those people when they get to the stage of actually stepping into those kind of leadership roles.
Absolutely. And you put so much pressure on yourself because you're supposed to be modeling it, because that's your role as the leader.
Totally.
And then you think, oh goodness, don't come into this classroom. But you go home, and the difference between me now to where I was perhaps 10 years ago is that I go home and I see it as a challenge, and I think, and I laugh about it, and I think, oh dear, that wasn't very good. And then I go and talk about it with teachers, because I want them to see, I want them to know that it, you know, it happens to everybody. What's your advice? You know, you start talking teaching and learning, and I think it's quite a good gateway to get to know your staff and colleagues as well.
Well, I had a bit of a thing as deputy, but also as head teacher, that I would take on the groups that were seen as the most challenging groups. I wanted to kind of have that credibility of teaching those groups. And frankly, some of those lessons I taught with those groups, incredibly challenging, and the kids were very difficult. And a bit like you're implying, Libby, I would be thinking, God, I hope nobody walks in and sees what this is like, because this is difficult. But the interesting thing you learn about it is you come out of some of those lessons thinking, that was terrible. How am I then going to pick up the pieces in the next lesson? The kids don't kind of remember it like that. The next lesson gives you a bit of a fresh start where you reestablish some of those expectations. And genuinely, I became a better teacher for learning my craft with those kinds of groups and thinking, can I take complicated stuff and make it straightforward, simple, but not too simple, so I'm not patronizing those young people. And I think a lot of the stuff I did about literacy, I learned not from teaching A-level students. I learned it from teaching my year 9, my year 10, more challenged groups, largely with boys in those, where I was trying to get them to engage with poems and plays and all kinds of stuff. But it really tested my ability. And I'm genuinely pleased to have done all of that. And I think some of them, if they were listening, would say, he wasn't such a bad teacher after all. I didn't learn something from him.
No, as I say, it's really good to talk about as well, because you do put a lot of expectation on yourself going into that new role as that leader.
You do, and you lose sleep about it, because you feel that your credibility with the rest of the staff has been undermined. You kind of assume that the staff are all saying, oh, he hasn't got the discipline, or she hasn't got the discipline, the kids are saying all of this kind of stuff. Yeah, we can beat ourselves up quite unnecessarily about all of this stuff.
And 2 weeks later is a different ball game. So
I walked
into a year 10 class 2 weeks ago, and it's completely different this morning. Yeah. I put myself in front of assemblies for them because I wanted them to see me in a different context, teaching something
good
that I was really confident in.
Yeah, that's good for you.
Thanks very much. Well, we'll see. I'll have them again on Thursday, so it might be different then. So my last question in the podcast is, what was your favourite memory or your favourite teacher at school and why?
Oh, well, the favourite teacher is a fairly straightforward one. I've just finished reading a book by Jonathan Bate, which is called Mad About Shakespeare. Jonathan Bate is probably the UK's leading expert on Shakespeare. And what he does is he talks about the English teachers and how they opened his mind to it. And it's a very unpretentious, beautiful book. And I sent a copy of that to my English teacher, Roy Sampson, who was the one when I didn't become Noel Edmonds and I drifted into the sixth form with very, very lacklustre results and pretty undistinguished academic credibility. He just opened my mind, and he just sent me this wonderful note saying, this is the best book I've read this month. It was the best book I've read this month as well for me. And that sense of what a teacher can do, often not realizing that long-term impact that they have on you. Roy is probably now in his late 80s. He's coming to visit us to stay for a weekend.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Very special bloke. He won't have realized that it's not just the Jeff Bartons of this world. There will be hundreds and hundreds of other people who won't be getting in touch with him, won't be sending him books, but whose lives were transformed by him. So Roy Sampson, I salute you.
And on that note, thank you so, so much for coming on the podcast, Jeff, and for giving up your time.
Well, sorry about the visuals. I think probably your listeners and viewers will think that is a bonus not to see Jeff on the screen.
It doesn't matter at all. There you go. It doesn't work all the time, does it? So.
No, great. Libby, thanks so much for the conversation. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To continue the conversation, head over to www.teachertoolkit.co.uk and our social media channels to access all the links and resources mentioned on today's show. Why not share this with your colleagues and give them the gift of time, reduced workload, and increased impact? Until the next time, before you look after your students, look after yourself.